Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joe Epstein, president of Sierra Steel Trading and a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. I'll be your moderator for tonight's program. I can't think of a more appropriate venue than the Lafayette Library and Learning Center to welcome tonight's Commonwealth Club guest, Mark Udoff, president of the University of California System. The Lafayette Library is also the home of the Glenn T. Seaborg Learning Consortium, a partnership with the region's leading arts, cultural, and educational institutions. Dr. Seaborg, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1951, was a professor and then chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley. Now, Mark Udoff is no stranger to high-pressure jobs and to challenges in education. As the president of the 10-campus University of California, he brings many years of experience to this office. And in addition to his most recent position as chancellor of the University of Texas, Mark Udoff held the Charles Allen Wright Chair in federal courts at the University of Texas School of Law. Previously, he was a faculty member and administrator at the University of Texas at Austin for 26 years and serving as dean of the law school from 1984 to 1994 and as the university's executive vice president and provost from 1994 to 1997. He joined the Texas faculty in 1971. And recently, in 2010, the regents of the University of Texas established the Mark and Judy Udoff Chair at the UT School of Law. Between 1997 and 2002, he served also as the president of the four-campus University of Minnesota. In 2008, Mark Udoff was selected as the next president of the University of California, succeeding Robert Dines. The Dines administration was controversial, but this apparently didn't scare Mark Udoff as he prepared to step into the hot seat as UC president. And perhaps the most difficult issue for Mr. Udoff has been dealing with the crisis in public education, which has been exacerbated by the dramatic decline of state funds earmarked for UC in the state of California's budget. Maintaining the UC model at the highest level, which provides universal access to top-notch, low-cost education and world-class research, was and still is a challenge to President Udoff, as you will hear tonight. As I said, President Udoff's challenges are many, and I think this excerpt from an op-ed piece by New York Times columnist Bob Herbert says it very well. And I quote, "The problems at UC are particularly acute because of the state's drastic reduction of support, but colleges and universities across the country, public and private, are struggling because of the prolonged economic crisis and the pressure on state budgets. It will say a great deal about what kind of a nation we've become if we let the most valuable assets slip into a period of decline." In November of 2009, Time magazine recognized President Udoff as one of the best college presidents, citing his efforts to provide opportunity and access to a quality education for California residents with financial need whose family has an income of less than $80,000. Well, Mark Udoff has a plan, and he's here to tell us why, under his watch, higher education at the University of California will not fall into decline. So please welcome the 19th president of the University of California, Mark Udoff.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you to the members of the Commonwealth Club for inviting me and for the guest. It's really an honor to be here this evening. And I only live about 3.5 miles away, so it's very convenient. My wife and I moved to Lafayette just over a year ago, and we absolutely love this community. The weather is wonderful. The neighbors are wonderful. The La Mirinda farmers markets are fantastic. And then there's the Philly cheesesteak shop. And in addition, my personal hairdresser is located here. Not that I see her all that often, to be honest with you, but there's only one thing that really bothers me about the community. Ever since I arrived, I keep hearing about something called the fourth bore of the Calicut Tunnel. And I can't help but wonder, are they talking about me? And if so, who are the other three bores that I need to meet? My purpose tonight is not to bore you, but I wanted to drill down on a few issues that are of great concern to me. And let me begin with the name of this distinguished forum, Commonwealth Club. The etymology of the word Commonwealth is very interesting. It comes from Middle English, has two components, obviously, common and wealth. And the word common is pretty much has maintained its linguistic history, meaning over all these years. But the word wealth, which today we usually mean someone is affluent, they have lots of property or personal goods or something, its first meaning was not that sort of wealth, but it meant well-being or welfare. I mean, the Commonwealth Club would be the common well-being or the common welfare of all the people and not a reference to wealth itself. So when we use Commonwealth today, we're talking about the public welfare or the public good. A Commonwealth is fundamental to the history of public research universities like the University of California. And it's something that's intrigued me since I arrived here 3.5 years ago. It's a notion that individuals and groups come together to achieve objectives. Now, those objectives may be a schoolhouse. Those objectives may be roads. They may be a fire station. It may be police protection or a war. But they come together to make common cause with each other. And we call those things private public goods as opposed to private goods. And public goods are things like the public water system or a public park, often non-rival in consumption and difficult to exclude in benefit. In other words, we all contribute something in return. We get tap water and a nice place to walk on a Sunday afternoon, say Lafayette Reservoir. That would be a common good, although the parking is fairly expensive, to be honest with you. And many goods by their nature are mixed. They're hybrids or public-private goods. So today we have private mediators that work with the state court system to mete out justice. In the 19th century, there was a transcontinental railroad. It was built with both government bonds and by private rail companies. And historically, hybrids like these have maintained a pretty good balance between the public and the private side. But what I wanted to say tonight is that in America, in the last few decades, a clear privatization trend has emerged. We are today building more toll roads than we build freeways. And I think the tipping of the balance in terms of many of these hybrid goods is toward the private. And we can argue and we can discuss why is that. You know, and it may be efficiency. It may be ideology. It may be demographics. It may be a distrust of how government carries out its functions. But I think, to my way of thinking, the trend is unmistakable. And this, in my judgment, and Joe and I were discussing this, Joe said, is this linear? Is this going to go on forever? I think the answer is probably not, that it's a pendulum. It goes back and forth. I mean, for a long time, the retirement was largely a private matter. And then in the 1930s, we have Social Security, and it becomes a public matter. Healthcare was a private matter for a very long period of time, and healthcare is probably the biggest exception to this trend that I'm talking about toward privatization. And so what I think we're seeing here is a swing away from public financial support for infrastructure. We're seeing large-scale privatization. And I won't go through endless examples. I mentioned the toll roads. Did you know that 69% of the United States forces in Afghanistan are private contractors? 69%. That's a 40% increase since the Korean War. I mean, the war, to a significant extent, has been privatized. NASA awarded $270 million outright to private American aerospace companies. The reason is because NASA no longer makes rockets. It no longer makes crew capsules. to take American astronauts into space, and it's looking to the private sector to fill the gap. The R&D function, as a percentage of GNP, has declined about 60% in the last 60 years. We now spend about as much on R&D research and development as we spend on potato chips. Although, to me, Pringles were a great leap forward. I just have to tell you my view of Pringles. But nonetheless, this is a stunning statistic. And we could go on, and you could think about the post office and lots of areas and gated communities where we have moved to more of a private delivery of goods, which were formerly thought to be public in nature. And public universities, not surprisingly, have historically been hybrid goods. There are substantial private returns to individuals who consume higher education. And therefore, it seems fair, to me it seems fair, most people, that if they're able to, the students and their families will pay for a portion of that education. On the other side, it's a public good because there are benefits that flow to all of us. They come in the form of cultural transmission. They come in the form of economic growth, more democratic participation. They come in the form of health care, higher tax revenues to fund other things, fewer incarcerations, and so forth. So it's both a private good benefiting families and individuals, and it's also a public good. But when it comes to funding these institutions, the pendulum has swung away from an emphasis on taxpayer support and toward one on tuition support. Or I can put it another way. The next time someone says, we balanced the budget, we didn't raise taxes in Sacramento, that is not literally true. I mean, because tuition is a tax. I mean, user fees are taxes. Now, we can argue about what's the fair distribution of that tax. Should it be all taxpayers, just the people who consume the service? How should it work? But it's not as if we'd got away without any tax increases. And I think a predecessor of mine at the University of Minnesota, James Lewis Morrill, had it right when he said, democracy is based upon the conviction that there are extraordinary possibilities in ordinary people, and the development of these extraordinary possibilities is the very reason and purpose of a state university. To underwrite the ongoing of their state university is the surest investment that the people of any state can make in their own future. And I, to put it bluntly, I could not agree more with Morrill. If you want a prosperous state, if you want a pioneering state, if you want to have a state in which there's more wealth to be shared, it makes sense to support your great universities. And let me explain a couple of things about it. You may read in the paper that it's sort of like that old Yogi Berra joke, that restaurant's so crowded no one goes there. You read in the paper that no one can afford the University of California, even though every year we have record applications and record financial aid, and it seems to be going pretty well, except for the lack of state support. But here's what I wanted to say. 40% of all University of California students, undergraduates, are Pell Grant recipients. That means they're in families making under $50,000. Now, you may think that's too much. Again, we could debate it, but it's highly redistributive. It's not a fixed upper class. It's not the 99 and the 1% that we hear so much about, with the 1% being fixed for all time. In fact, a very substantial slug of all UC students are from relatively modest income families, low-income families. Often English is not the primary language spoken in a home, and a huge chunk of them are the first to go to college in their families. That's smart to educate these young people, who have enormous potential and otherwise could be a burden on others. We also have 57 Nobel laureates. Now, I have to tell you, I'm not one of them. Nobel didn't really like lawyers much. He didn't really like mathematicians either, so there are no Nobel Prizes in those areas. And you might have noted that Saul Perlmutter, just over the hill at the Berkeley Lab, won one recently because the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. Saul won't tell me why. I think he really doesn't know. But he won the Nobel Prize for proving what he did. And you might have read recently, in the last couple of years, the Nobel Prize in Medicine went to a UCSF professor and so forth. And as a result of this research mission, for 17 consecutive years, UC has had more patents than any other university in the United States. And its hospitals train one out of two California doctors. And they treat over 4 million patients a year. So if you're really comfortable that you're never going to get sick, then you don't have to worry about the University of California. But if you're concerned that you have well-trained people who know what they're doing at your bedside, then we are a big part of that solution. So my point is this, that the University of California touches everyone. And I understand, if you work there and you draw a salary, of course, you have a more direct interest. And of course, if you're a student there or you're getting a graduate degree, a professional degree, you have a direct interest. But my point is, everyone has an interest in how well this institution survives. Now, what's been happening in California and across the country, at least 28 states, higher education budgets have been slashed. So let me tell you the true story. Our budget since 1990, adjusting for inflation, has been cut two-thirds. Way back when, we were two or three times what they spend on prisons. Now we're very generous to prisoners and prison guards. We are not so generous to the young people in the state. That is just the way it is. And you say, well, your tuition has gone up. But tuition has probably made up about a third of that loss. Most of the rest has come from cutting our budgets and trying to streamline, and to some extent, larger classes and things that I would prefer that we did not do. So I see this as a very worrisome trend, and I predict probably, I mean, I'm not sure, but it looks like we will probably be reduced another $100 million in January. On June the 30th, we were reduced $650 million. Our fiscal year starts on July 1st. How many business people would like to see their budget cut by 20-25% the day before your new fiscal year starts in terms of your planning horizon? And so I'm very worried that this is a trend that is not good for the country. Now, we could talk about the reasons for this, and I'll mention a few, and you may disagree. One is demography, clearly, even though we have a growing Hispanic population in the state. In the 1960s, 57% of American families had children under the age of 18. Today, it is 46%. And the families with no children under the age of 18 tend to vote more and to turn out more than the families with children. That was not true in the Obama election 2008, but as a generalization, that is true. Another feeling is, which again I share, is that the students should have some skin in the game. I mean, if you will earn a lot more money if you graduate from college than from high school, and we know that the unemployment rate is roughly 4.5% for college grads. It's over 10% for high school grads. But I think that is fair. And then I think the downturn has had an effect. I mean, not only on the state dollars, but if you're struggling to make ends meet and you're senior citizens, you're worried about your health care and you have all sorts of other issues, there's a great temptation to say, you know, why should I be paying for someone else's kids? And it turns out, by the way, a lot of those someone else's kids are Hispanic kids. A majority of them are Hispanic kids. So I think the legislature see that and they respond in part to that. So what I see is a partial abandonment of state support for public universities. And I think there are a number of reasons to think that this is problematic. It creates haves and have-nots within the universities. Guess which raises more money privately, the engineering college or the Renaissance Art Department, right? I mean, people are people, you know, and who has the deeper pockets and so forth. Most of the money we receive, and we have some very generous donors, but less than 2% is unrestricted. So a lot of the money is for cancer research, which is great that we get the money, or for the civil engineering chair, or for the real estate law chair, but very little of it can go into the basic education of the undergraduates. I'm also afraid that even though we try our best with the scholarships, it can be daunting for a family to look at a sticker shock and higher price tag, and we can talk about that. So I don't see the solution as entirely one of higher tuition and entirely one of private funding, although I'm trying some of that, all that, really. Tuition has gone up a great deal. I think we need to have a come to Moses meeting. Others might characterize it differently. A come to Moses meeting about what is the proper role of this state, and do we want the best prison system, or at least the largest, or are we interested in how well these kids do in school and whether they are trained for jobs and whether they have ideas for new products and all the rest of that. And that, I think, comes from a public university. So I think we need a better division of the responsibility. And let me give you an example. I'm sure many of you in this room remember Earl Warren, great Chief Justice of the United States, Governor of California. He came from a working-class immigrant family in Bakersfield, California. His immigrant father joked that he was too poor to have a middle name. So Earl Warren didn't have a middle name. No one in his family had a college degree. And yet, because the University of California accepted students from all socioeconomic backgrounds, Warren graduated from UC Berkeley. And for the rest of his life, he credited the university with shaping his incredible career. Now, I go out and I visit high schools as part of my job. In fact, it's the joy of my job to visit high schools and with students rather than writing endless memos and having endless meetings. And I go out to meet the new Earl Warrens of the state, the new Earl Warrens. They're in towns like Watsonville and East Fresno and Boyle Heights. And just like Warren, they're mostly working class, mostly from immigrant families. But their names are likely to be Ernesto or Elena, much more likely than to be Earl. And they've bent on achieving dreams just as lofty as Warren's dreams, dreams that will ultimately benefit all of us. And just like Warren, they know that their ticket is a college education. In fact, last Monday, I spoke at the Roosevelt High School in East Los Angeles. It's the largest high school in California. It possesses one of the lowest graduation rates, 41%. It's almost 100% Hispanic. Most of the kids are from low-income families. I really enjoyed my visit. They had a mariachi band, and they played El Rey for me, which really appealed to me, and it was very nice. But my message to those students was simple, and Joe mentioned it, that if you work hard and you qualify for UC, you take your A through G courses, we will have a place for you, and we will find the financial aid if you make $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000. And that message is so important. We cannot give up on these students. But we're facing a dilemma. We can only accommodate so many of them. Only 7% of all Hispanic students graduate with the necessary coursework to attend the University of California. So we have a problem both in the pipeline, on the supply side, on the demand side, and we also have it on the supply side. And this is why I think it's important to all of us. Even if you do not have a student currently at the university, it is very, very important that for the economy of the state, for the well-being of the state, for the democracy that is California, for the fact that we want well-trained air traffic controllers, and we'd sort of like the person jabbing you in the arm to know the difference between a vein and an artery. Maybe obvious to some, but it's real important to us. We need to have that educated population, and we did historically. And we opened 3 additional campuses, and we enrolled tens of thousands of additional students. But now that dream is beginning to fade, I fear. And I sit in my office, and it sometimes galls me. I have visitors from all around the world, from Saudi Arabia to Wales to Western Europe, and they say, we want to do what you did at the University of California. And here I'm frightened to death that the place where it actually happened, where it succeeded in creating the greatest public university in the world, that it is in jeopardy. And the last thing I wanted to say about this, and I used to teach constitutional law, I taught local government law. Our problem, in my judgment, is more political than anything else. This is a state that has almost a $2 trillion economy. It is the 8th largest economy, even today, in the world. Our current deficit is $26.6 billion. When Californians drive from LAX to UCLA or down 101 in Silicon Valley, they pass all these new office complexes and shopping malls. They share the potholed road with all the employee shuttle buses for thriving companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft. The point is, it's not the California economy that's broken. It's the California political processes and the political structures that are broken. We can argue till the cows come home, more cuts, more revenue, combination of the two, over what period of time, but it can be done. But the political process is broken, and you know about that, the initiative and the referendum and the supermajorities and term limits. It has made it very impractical for very good-willed people to change the way things are. So what I think, then, is we need to regroup. I'm fond of saying this, Wallace Stegner once said, California created a society to match its scenery, which is no easy matter. And I think we really have to rededicate ourselves. We need to make sure we leave it better than we received it. We need to make sure the Ernestos and the Elenas deserve no less than the Earls. And we need to protect this university, which I think has had a symbiotic relationship with California that is very difficult to imagine one without the other. And for one, I think we're going to get it right. I work every day to try to get it right. And I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, President Mark Udoff, President of the University of California. President Udoff's going to join me here in a nice, comfortable seat. Thanks for your remarks. We have a lot of questions that I have researched and proposed for tonight's program, and as I said earlier, we're also going to have live audience questions. So the microphone is over there. I will advise you when there's about 10 or 15 minutes left to go in the program. So those of you that have questions, you can line up. I'd like to stay with the theme of privatization, if I could, for a moment. I think, as I mentioned to you a few minutes ago, in private, I have the privilege of serving on one of the boards at one of the schools at UC, the Goldman Public Policy School. And we just had a board meeting last week, and we talked about how we're going to survive and how we're going to be competitive and to pay salaries for academics and administrative staff. And we sort of labeled it the business of education. And to me, that's sad. Education should not be a business. It should be a right. I remember as a young man, a young boy actually, there was something called the International Correspondence School. I don't know how many of you can remember International Correspondence School. Some of my friends, my more intelligent friends, while I was out playing ball, they were out taking tests and studying and learning to get additional degrees and additional education. So that's really a segue, President Udoff, into a way that maybe the university can make money or maybe they are making money. I would call it a distance learning. New York Times recently published an article on distance learning, and they called it the University of Wherever. Just wondering whether UC is planning to follow the model of DeVries University, University of Phoenix, and others, and have a for-profit distance learning program.
Well, we're going to do distance learning, but we're not going to follow the DeVries or the Phoenix model. We have to maintain the quality of this university. So we're doing a program right now, which we're funding internally, where we will create 25 or 30 core courses in the undergraduate curriculum by our own professors, and they will do it online, and it'll be high touch, meaning there'll be recitation periods with grad students and all that. So we're going to give it a ride, because what it means is if it's successful qualitatively and the students enjoy it, and many members of the faculty do not yet accept distance learning, that's an issue, and some do. It will either lower our marginal cost, to be crass about it, or at the very least we can educate more students. So that's one model. We also have a program called Encore, which is just being coming into fruition at UCLA. Encore really is for people who are mid-career that want to get certificates, or they're interested in Japanese art, or They want some healthcare courses, and those courses will be online. We'll also probably, when we produce this content, we'll probably also make it available abroad for a price. And so we'll have to see. I mean, I'm positive 25 years from now we'll have a great many of these courses across America. But so far they haven't really changed the game plan. But I they're not a game changer. But I think ultimately they will.
I've always wondered, how do you replace the energy that students receive at a great university like UC when you're in a classroom and there's questions and you feel the interest and how bright the students are? I mean, it sort of raises the boat to a higher level. You can't do that with distance.
Well, I think we have to be very careful. I mean, I certainly don't see sending Johnny to his room for 4 years and announcing he gets a UC degree. So you have to be careful. I mean, you know, it probably isn't for all courses, but as you point out, there are various models out there. I mean, Carnegie Mellon, no slacker as a university, is doing a great deal of this stuff. The for-profits tend to cherry-pick more without getting too specific. They tend to have specific types of students that they're trying to assist. But I agree with that. And you also have to see a lot of this is going to happen whatever we think. You know, I know a medical student, and if he doesn't like the instructor, he just there's an iCast. Brandon, you would know. That's iPod where you receive it on your computer, and he never goes to class. Mm-hmm. He just listens to the lecture there. So,
podcast.
That's what I meant to say. I know all this cutting edge stuff. Podcast, and so it's already happening. You know, and it's not entirely my cup of tea, to be honest. I never used audiovisual aids. I thought my job was to stand up there and oppress the law students with questions. And not to draw anything, you know, so, but anyhow. But your point's well taken. But I don't think there's one flavor for all. We already have a lot of students who are getting online degrees. The question is, what are they really worth? What are the qualitative standards? How do we know that if you're an employer, you know, how do you treat these degrees?
Are executive programs similar, or are they different in a better way? I noticed that University of California has a joint executive MBA degree with Columbia University.
Right. Well, they're normally a combination. Normally, there's some summers involved, and you have to come to the campus, and there's some online stuff, and then there are papers. So I think ultimately it's going to be a hybrid. I mean, all of these models, it will not be like the old days of education TV where you just sit down and you watch this screen for 2 hours and then take a test. It will be more involved. And by the way, there's some things you can do in this mode that are difficult otherwise. I mean, we have a new era of textbooks, you know, so that, I mean, you can have endless pictures, right, on an e-version of a textbook. If you're taking a Spanish course, you can have a pronunciation repeated 100 times if that's what you need. And so there are things in this medium that you really can't do as well in a traditional medium.
While I was preparing for this program a few days ago, I almost fell off my chair, and I read a comment by former Regents President Richard Blum. And again, this is keeping it with the theme of public versus private or privatization. You mentioned toll roads. You mentioned the military. But Regent Blum has been quoted publicly as suggesting that possibly the entire or part of the University of California system be privatized. Now, I'm sure you're very friendly with Richard Blum and have had a lot of discussions with him. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, I'd prefer not to elaborate, but I don't remember him using those exact words, but I trust you if you have it there. When I've talked to Dick about these issues, he's actually he thinks probably the prices will need to go up. And then the question is, how do we protect not only the poor kids but the middle-class kids, which is very expensive, by the way, because there's so many of them. But and so that's what we've been thinking about. We've launched a corporate scholarship drive. I was down in Pebble Beach. It was a terrible job, but I had to do it. And We launched our scholarship drive, and we're going to have other soirees and try to get in to see the corporations and have them give scholarships a certain amount each year for 5 years. I think I don't think Dick meant to give up on our public mission or to give up on the poor kids or to give up on Californians. I think what he means is we're going to have rising prices, and how are we going to deal with that? That's my interpretation.
He did mention that there's a considerable amount of money in the private sector. I think we all know that, with corporations and so forth. And so there is a private university model, which is higher fees and, I believe, higher scholarships as opposed to the public university model typically. And I know you're trying to maybe make a hybrid in some sense, right, to have a large scholarship program, as you've indicated. One of the things that you have said that you would do in order to maintain the very high quality of the University of California is to manage costs. And I don't think that includes, nor do I think it should, my opinion, professors' salaries. But there might be an issue with some administrative salaries. There's one in particular that I noticed, and you have a person whose name I think I should probably not mention, but this person is the chief UC investment officer. And according to the research that I did, this person got a bonus, which I would guess is contractual, an incentive bonus of about $750,000, which would raise her total salary to $1.2 million.
I don't remember those exact figures, but, you know, there are a lot of myths out there. And let me say, we're in a lot of different businesses. So we have an investment arm, and we have $60, $70 billion of assets, including pension benefits and including the endowment of the university. Not all of it, but a big chunk of it. Well, I'm sorry, you have to be competitive for those people. You know, when you're running $70 billion, a 5 basis point shift is an enormous amount of money if you make more money. So, you know, it turns out that if you look up what people are paid for running huge outfits like this and what we need to do to sustain it, the salary's high. And, you know, I'll admit it, we have neurosurgeons that make $800,000 a year, because otherwise we don't have any neurosurgeons. And I can't just take anyone off the street and put them in charge of a multi-billion-dollar endowment and hope for the best. I mean, I know that's somehow not what all Californians think about these issues, but from my standpoint, there are markets out there. The second thing is they don't come from state funds. The state is 11% of our budget. We have a $22 billion budget. The most successful thing we do is health care. And they want to tell me how much we need to pay to bring in the docs that will treat the patients who are perfectly, and their insurers willing to pay it to get high quality health care. So, and the third thing I would say is that when you look at the number of administrators, the only thing that's really growing is, because our research budget is growing, $5 billion, our medical center budget is growing, you know, $6, $7, $8 billion. The only administrators we're really hiring are the ones necessary for the administration of the research programs and the hospitals, and they're not paid out of state funds. So that's my story.
Yeah, and it's a good story. And believe me, the comment that I made was not to be taken in terms of a criticism, because right. I also read, as I was doing the research, that these are contractual components of that person and other person's salary. So if you want to be competitive, right, bring somebody good, that's
yeah,
nuts.
You know, I was paid less than the offensive coach at UCLA. It really hurt my feelings. And I thought my record was better. I thought I had more wins. Not to pile it on UCLA, but it's not been a good year for them.
That's right. Well, staying with professor salaries, you can correct me if I don't have this right, but since you were recently at the University of Texas and now at the University of California, fortunately for us, my sources say that the average professor salary at UC is about $149,000, and it ranks Berkeley amongst national universities as number 13, whereas the University of Texas has an average salary, professors have an average salary of $136,500, which puts UT at number 36. Do those sound like...
It sounds approximately accurate. Right. The problem the University of California has is we have a peer group, and our peer group is both public and private. We lost three neuroscientists to Rice recently from San Diego. Big loss. All National Academy members, first-class faculty members. So we're competing with the Rice and the Vanderbilts and the Emory's and Chicago and Harvard's and MIT's and so forth of the world. But you're right. I think we actually do pretty well compared to Michigan and University of Texas and Penn State and Washington and so forth. And so we're sort of a hybrid.
Getting back to my position on the Goldman Public Policy Board, we've discussed over the years how the University of Texas always had so much money available that they were one of the biggest competitors to keep academics at UC in addition to being at the public policy school. Well, here you are. You were recruited as the president of the University of California from the University of Texas. So maybe we just got even with UT by bringing you over here. So no comment on that.
No, I'm not going to say anything about that. Just get into trouble.
California's budget crisis. I wanted to get this question in, and I wasn't quite sure how to frame it other than to say, since you were president of the four-campus University of Minnesota and at the University of Texas, which I believe is, what, an eight or nine campus?
15.
15 campus institution. You had the opportunity to work, as you do in California, with some really interesting governors.
Indeed, yeah.
In Minnesota, was it Jesse Ventura?
Jesse the Body Ventura. He wanted arm wrestle. I said, how about checkers? You know, something I might possibly win. And he was an interesting fellow. And of course, Governor Schwarzenegger here and now. Governor Brown. I've met quite a number of times Governor Brown. I like him. He pushes me intellectually. He always wants to talk about St. Augustine and Aquinas and people like that. And I'm thinking, boy, did I take a course in that? I'm trying to put it all together. But I've enjoyed it. And we're having discussions with him. I really think we need a long-term plan for the University of California. We need it for all of higher ed. But it's not a sustainable path we're on. Something's going to give. The quality is going to give, or the access is going to give. And he seems receptive to that. But, you know, the money's not there today. So,
was Governor Pawlenty in office when you were there in Minnesota?
No. You know, I know Tim. When I was there, he told me he was going to run against Ventura, who people thought was impregnable, but It turned out he decided not to run, and Tim was elected, yeah.
And then in Texas, presidential candidate Rick Perry.
Yeah, I know Rick Perry, and I don't have anything more to say. I knew George Bush.
Right. In terms of, you know, Texas has a reputation of the governor's office having much less power and authority than they do in California.
That's true.
And so in terms of education and public education in the universities of these great states, can you just briefly make a differentiation between what it is like dealing with the governor's office in this state versus other states where you've been?
Well, I would say Minnesota and California have strong gubernatorial systems in terms of their ability to veto things and to take things out of the budget. They have more power to appoint people. So I would say Minnesota and Texas, there was more incentive to try to cut a deal with the governor if you could. In Texas, you know, when I talked to Governor Perry a great deal, and he did submit some plans for higher education, but it just didn't have quite as much zip behind it because he really didn't have all the collateral powers that these governors in other states have. Mm-hmm. It's not meant as a criticism. That's just the system.
Let me just take a very brief break, and let the radio audience know that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker today is Mark Udoff, University of California president, who is discussing the fate of higher education in California and nationwide. And I'm Joe Epstein, past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. President Udoff, diversity has been a mainstay of this university, and it's been a mainstay of some of your programs. Has the budget crisis hampered the University of California and yourself to achieve what is its diversity goals?
Well, I think the honest answer is it probably has. We scrupulously abide Proposition 209. That's the will of the people of California. But if we had better financing, I think we could probably enroll over time 20,000 additional students, maybe not at Berkeley or UCLA, but Merced, Riverside, Davis. And invariably, that would create some additional opportunities. I would say that's – and then, in terms of we don't have as much money as we'd like for outreach and student services and the like. So it's hard to quantify, but I would say the answer is probably yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it more difficult dealing with the various chancellors of the 10 campuses or with the Board of Regents?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think of the chancellors as like Caesar going to the Roman Senate. I just watch those robes very carefully and make sure they're not armed. I would say, by virtue of its size and its experience, the Board of Regents has more diverse viewpoints. I mean, the chancellors, for better or worse, I mean, they're going to have, they're all professional in higher education, have been at it a long time, so there's a more ready understanding. And in Board of Regents, people come from all walks of life, but that's really a strength in a way. Education is too important only to be left to professional educators. That's why we have lay leaders, but it does make it more difficult, I think, to balance all the interest out.
How does the student representative to the Board of Regents act? That's a one-year term, I understand, yeah. Whereas the regents normally have a 12-year appointed term.
Yeah, I think it works pretty well. If I had my druthers about it, they would have longer terms, because by the time they learn the system, we're moving on to the next student regent. In general, they're responsible. I don't think I will live so long that a student regent will ever vote for a tuition increase. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very constituency-driven, but I understand that. And they do contribute on lots of other issues and even on that one. So I'm just wondering if we're supposed to be taking questions yet.
We have about 5 minutes, and we're going to ask members of the audience. Right, to.
I see someone anxiously at the mic over here. So.
Right. Well, he's making sure that it's going to be orderly and an appropriate okay. process. I have a question getting back to the various chancellors. I'm not sure whether you would refer to it as tuition deregulation or tuition independence, but there's a system, and I'm not sure whether you instituted it or whether it's been a historical precedent, where the various chancellors are submitting their budgets to you, and you've obviously had to give them some guidelines under the new funding or lack of funding from the state of California.
Yeah, well, we have a highly decentralized system. It's like a federalist system, and in the large, we approve the budget, but mostly at the margins, approving what we're going to spend to deal with our energy costs, what we're going to spend on contracts we've reached with union members, a big deal is our retirement plan. And you may have read a lot about this, but we actually did reform our retirement plan. We're way out ahead of the state on that, but we're the only group of employees that doesn't get a state contribution. And I'm trying to fix that. But anyhow, the major items and the new expenditures tend to be approved centrally. But I really don't try to administer the chemistry department or the architecture college or anything mm-hmm. like that. They are responsible for balancing the budget. So every year we do take a careful look at what their reserves are and how much they've spent, and making sure that they haven't started capital projects they can't afford. I mean, we're the eyes and ears of the Board of Regents for that. They do not set tuition. That's a board function. In many states, it's a legislative function. But California, it's a Board of Regents function.
The University of Southern California has
There is
a,
one?
There is one, yes.
Oh,
there is
okay.
one. Yeah, there's several universities
oh,
in Southern
darn.
California. This one we know as USC, the Trojans.
Uh-huh.
They have the highest enrollment of international students in the United States.
Really? Hmm.
UCLA ranks among the top 20% in the USA, whereas the UC system currently has, according to my research again, about 6% of its undergraduate enrollment right. from out of state, which also includes international. So in terms of fees, the international students or out-of-state students, I believe, pay something like three times what
right.
undergraduates
right.
pay. What is your feeling in terms of the impetus to get more international and get more out-of-state students, and how does that affect the
Well, my feeling is that we're quintessentially a California institution. The taxpayers built it over the last 140-some years, but the 6% is too low. And that we can have additional revenues and have a, what if I can put it this way, a more global experience for all our students if that figure went to 8 or 10% over the next 5 or 10 years. So that's sort of where we are. But we're a public university. Now, I mean, it does get to be annoying because there seems to be a rule, the less money they give you, the more control the legislature wants. You know, when you're 11% of the budget, you're saying, you know, well, that's an important 11%, but still. So I think you'll see it grow. It'll help us financially. It will also help us in terms of the type of global campus environment. But Michigan undergraduate must be 40 or 50% at Michigan. I don't think that's in the cards. California is a very different state and a very different institution.
Well, this is the time to ask members of the audience to go up to the microphone, please. And while you are doing that, I'm going to ask President Udoff another question. I hope there are some energetic listeners here. So please head over to the microphone, and I'll ask President Udoff the following question. Could you please describe the UC Blue and Gold Opportunity Plan?
Yeah, what it is currently is that if you're financially aid eligible and your family makes under $80,000 a year, you don't pay any tuition. It's largely built on the Pell Grants and on the Cal Grants. So it's sort of like an insurance policy. It's actually not as much money as you would think. But when you're trying to recruit low-income kids, clarity is very important. Then there are, for families between $80,000 and $120,000, there are other forms of assistance that we give them. It's a very complicated picture because all these students qualify for Stafford loans. And then under the Obama tax credits, families up to $180,000 get a $2,500 tax credit for each child who's enrolled in a qualified institution. But that's essentially the program. Now, if you have, you won't be financially aid qualified if you have a trust fund or own 10,000 mm-hmm. acres mm-hmm. Near Santa Monica.
Well, I wish I had more details on this as a tag to that answer and to the question, but I heard just tonight that the federal government, in terms of Pell Grants, has decided that students can repay those Pell Grants at a slower rate.
I haven't seen the details of that. I don't think it's Pell. I think it's federal loans, mm-hmm. but I haven't seen the details of that. I mean, there is a problem in Washington. The cost of the Pell Grant program has doubled in the last 3 years. It's gone from about 15, give or take, or 17, something like that, to $34 billion. So it's widely thought in Washington to be unsustainable at its current growth rate. So people are trying to figure out how to do this.
Okay, well, I see we have several people standing at the microphone. Sir, would you care to identify yourself and ask
the
question?
Yeah, my name is Tom Barnage. 2 years ago, when UC Berkeley was asked to reduce its budget by $150 million, the chancellor's solution was to spend $3 million on Bain & Company consultants for advice on how to save $150 million. I wondered how that $3 million investment worked out.
Well, I think the largest part of the Bain & Company was incentive, that they got paid a percentage of what they saved. I can't honestly say I have the exact figures, but my impression is they've had pretty substantial savings. And my impression, maybe you and perhaps others would disagree, that type of saving was not likely to be generated internally, that you needed to have someone from the outside take a hard look, that we were, many of our constituents were too dug in on the way that we currently did business. But you're right, it was a cost item, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. My name is Eva Santelli, and I'm a local parent from Walnut Creek, and I am happy to say I have a senior daughter who's at Las Lomas High School, and she intends to apply to the University of California system. Our family definitely supports the purpose of the UC system, but I would want... I wanted to ask, it's my impression that coming from an area of wealth and good education, that a suburban kid doesn't have the same kind of opportunities, admission opportunities, as, say, kids from lower achieving areas who are great students. Do you have any... feelings about that? For one thing, we received a letter. It was an ELD designation, meaning she was in the top 15% of seniors based on her school, and that the career counselor mentioned that if you got that letter and you were from an urban area, that would mean that would be significant. But in the case of my daughter, she's kind of like a dime a dozen. So do you have any
Well, that's not my understanding. I mean, it is, I'll try to give the most honest answer I can give you. There's a new admission system going into effect this year, and the local percentage is the top 9%. And if you're in the top 9% coming from one of the high schools here, you know, that's the first step in terms of UC eligibility, and you're in. Now, you can criticize it because it may be your high school is much more competitive than another high school in a poorer area of the state where the scores are not as high, and I mean, I understand that. The other thing is that it is a holistic review process, so they look at things other than numbers. I mean, there's no absolutely fair admissions system, but I think we have to look at the whole student, and we do look at the local numbers, and we also, of course, look at the SAT scores and all the rest. And your daughter's not a dime a dozen. I'd like to admit them all. I mean, they're all, if we're going to use metaphors, more like beautiful butterflies. But we can't do that because we just are overwhelmed with applications. And so I would say to apply to more than one campus, try to get in that top 9%, make sure you've nailed those A through G courses, and we'll all hope for the best.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Carol Cole, and I'm a Swiss American.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I want to say is I had a problem with...
Speak into the mic, please.
Sorry. The disrespect that I heard from an adult here towards you. I've been here now 8 years. I immigrated back to California. And I'm finding that even the very educated people here sometimes show a real lack of respect. And I see that also in teenagers. This is just a sidebar. I am proud to say I went to UC Santa Barbara, and I had the best 6 years of my life at that university. I met an international professor who allowed me to have a chance to go to Switzerland, and I stayed there for 25 years. Yeah. And I had always told my two teenagers that someday we would go back to California because I wanted to make sure that my kids had a wider lens to the world by not only knowing Switzerland but the U.S. and experiencing what I experienced. So we came in 2003. Now I look at them, and there's 16, and I'm embarrassed to say I'm thinking of going back to Switzerland, and I kind of want to hear what I can say and what I can think right now. What can I offer my kids? What's the best thing I can do right now? And it is even to give back, because I'd love to give back. I have an idea of regarding a healthcare situation where we can have expertise exchange. The Swiss are very big in preventative healthcare. And if we could do programs, for example, to send our students over there and bring them here, they're so interested in UC medical knowledge and expertise. There are so many things that could be done if we opened up. Huge nutshell, is there a future?
You know, obviously the Swiss have some very fine universities that are highly ranked in the world. But the University of California is more than any place in the world. I mean, there are six of our universities are ranked usually in the top 40 universities in the world, starting with Berkeley and Davis and Santa Barbara and San Diego and of course, UCSF, which is really not a university. Let me put it this way. I think most countries in the world would gladly swap their higher education system for the University of California, because no one has as many of these first-tier, first-class research universities accessible, and the price tag, and we've talked a lot about the price tag, but the price tag is lower than Penn State, it's lower than Michigan, it's lower than Illinois. It's actually a little bit lower even than the UK under the recent iteration. So I would tell your children that, I mean, they should go to the university that best meets their needs and their interests and do their research and so forth. But these universities have not slid. I'm worried that they might someday, but sitting here today, these are fabulous experiences. Santa Barbara has five Nobel laureates. It has the marine science program. It has a great beach. it's a wonderful place where you went. And Henry Yang, I said, why don't you go arrange a point? We go see Henry, the chancellor. Bring your kids in tow and talk to him. I admit I'm biased, and I certainly wouldn't knock the Swiss or any of the major European universities, but the scale of what they do is not the same as UC.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Hi, my name is John Eaton, and I received a copy of a pledge put together by a coalition of students and parents and teachers, researchers and workers at UC, they call it the Pledge to Refund California, and they're particularly talking about refunding.
Yes, sir.
So they have some very specific things that they're interested in, including getting support for closing Prop 13 or increasing income tax rates on the most wealthy in California. Is that the sort of thing that you yourself can support, or or your colleagues?
I think not, actually. The students, you know, they're free and they can support whatever causes they want and with whatever language they want, not whatever language, but most language. My own view is that. As a general matter, it's inappropriate for me to tell Californians how they should tax themselves or what should happen to Proposition 13 or how to divvy up the budget. I can articulate the needs of the University of California, but these are very controversial things that they're advocating. So, you know, and our Board of Regents and I, we stay away from it. You know, the only type of thing, if there was, I remember once there was a ballot measure for hospitals, and we have some children's hospitals that would benefit. If we had a direct interest, we would. But in general, I have stayed away from that because you alienate a lot of your friends, but it's not my role. I don't know more about that than you do. I can tell you what we need at the university, but in terms of cuts and taxes and all, that's sort of above my pay grade is the way I view it.
Thank you, sir. Well, we've reached the point of the program where there's time for just one more brief question, and I wanted to ask President Udoff, September 22nd, I believe, was the day that students protested and occupied Tolman Hall at the university. And then a little while later, we have Occupy Wall Street. So you know you're at the University of California when protests take place. Do you expect more protests, and do you have a plan that you're happy with to deal with these and to make sure that the students are heard, they get their thoughts out, but that they're also peaceful demonstrations where nobody gets injured?
Well, I think, I mean, Occupy Something is in every newspaper now, although I haven't seen Occupy Pebble Beach yet, but we do have plans. I mean, we respect the right to protest, to articulate their point of view, to chant, to carry signs, but there's no right to occupy buildings. So, you know, I guess without getting into the details, you know, we have elaborate plans for our police officers to be there and hopefully to keep things peaceful and nonviolent, but fully enable the students to articulate their point of view. And the people who wrote that that postcard or whatever you were reading there, I mean, every board meeting, the head of the student association tells us what she thinks about the issues. We have a couple of student regents. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity for them to peacefully express their point of view, and I'm hopeful. But it is coming from Texas. You know, there was, if you go to the airport in Dallas, there's a statue, and it says, "One riot, one ranger." That was sort of the Texas attitude. I've noticed it's slightly different in Berkeley, but maybe I'm overly sensitive. So, thank you.
Our thanks to UC President Mark Udall for his remarks here tonight, and we also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned. Thank you for all of you for being here.